Chapter 36. Nichols had donned his overcoat and was stuffing papers inside his attaché case before departing for home when his secretary leaned through his open door. "A gentleman from Langley is here with a drop. Have him come in." A CIA agent, whom Nichols recognized, entered carrying an old-fashioned leather accountant-style briefcase. "You caught me just in time, Keith," said Nichols. "I was on my way home." Keith Farquhar had a bushy mustache, thick brown hair, and wore horn-rimmed glasses. A large, no-nonsense type of man with contemplative eyes, he was, Nichols thought, the kind of agent who made up the solid bulwark of the Central Intelligence Agency. Without an invitation, Farquhar sat down in a chair, placed the case on his lap, and set the correct numbers on a combination lock that released the catch and switched off the circuit of a small incendiary explosive inside. He lifted out a thin file and placed it on the desk in front of Nichols. "Mr. Brogan instructed me to tell you that hard data on Ahmad Yazid is extremely sparse. Biographical records regarding birth, parents and ancestors, schooling, marriage, children, or any mention in legal proceedings, either criminal or civil, are virtually non-existent. Most of what our Middle East section was able to put together comes from descriptions of people who have known him. Unfortunately, most of them, for one reason or another, became enemies of Yazid, so their accounts are somewhat biased." "Did your psychological section make up a profile?" asked Nichols. "They put together a rough projection. Yazid is as hard to penetrate as a desert sandstorm. A shroud of security has covered him in mystery. Journalists' interviews with people around him are met with ambiguity and vague shrugs." "Which adds to the mirage," commented Nichols. Farquhar smiled. "Mr. Brogan's exact description of Yazid, an elusive mirage." "Thank you for bringing the file by," said Nichols, "and thank everyone involved with assembling the information for me. Anything for a client?" Farquhar snapped the catches closed on his briefcase and ambled toward the door. "Have a nice evening." "You too." Nichols buzzed for his secretary. She appeared wearing a coat and holding a purse. "Anything I can do before I leave?" she asked apprehensively, afraid she would be asked to work overtime for the third night in a row. "Could you please call my wife on your way out?" asked Nichols, "and tell her not to worry. I'll make the dinner party, but we'll be delayed for about half an hour." His secretary sighed thankfully. "Yes, sir, I'll tell her. Good night." "Good night." Nichols slipped his pipe between his teeth, but didn't pack or light the bowl. He set his attaché case off to the side of his desk, and, still wearing his overcoat, he sat down and examined Yazid's file. Farquhar had not exaggerated. It was slim pickings. Although the last 6 years were heavily reported, Yazid's life before his rapid rise from obscurity took up little more than a paragraph. His debut in the news media began with his arrest by Egyptian police during a sit-in demonstration for Cairo's starving masses inside the lobby of a luxury tourist hotel. He had distinguished himself by preaching in the worst slum areas of the country. Ahmad Yazid stated he was born in squalid poverty in a mud hut among the decaying mausoleums of the City of the Dead that spilled into the garbage dumps of Cairo. His family lived on the thin margin between survival and death until his two sisters and father died from disease brought on by hunger and filthy living conditions. He had no formal schooling except what was given during his adolescent years by Islamic holy men, none of whom were found to back up this assertion. Yazid claimed Muhammad the Prophet spoke through him, uttering divine revelations to the faithful and urging them to return Egypt to a utopian Islamic state. Yazid possessed a resonant speaking voice. He had the skilled mannerisms and delivery to enrapture a crowd of listeners, slowly building them to a fever pitch at the finish. He insisted Western philosophy was incapable of resolving Egypt's social-economic problems. He preached that all Egyptians are members of a lost generation who must find themselves through his moral vision. Though he vehemently claimed otherwise, evidence indicated he was not above using terrorism to achieve his goals. 5 separate incidents, including the murder of a high-ranking Air Force general, a truck explosion outside the Soviet embassy, and the execution-style killing of 4 university teachers who spoke out in favor of Western ways, were traced to Yazid's doorstep. Nothing was proven, but through sketchy information gained from Muslim informants, CIA analysts felt certain Yazid was planning a masterstroke to eliminate President Hassan and sweep into power on a rising wave of public acclaim. Nichols laid down the file and finally filled and lit his pipe. A tiny, indefinable thought tugged at him from the far reaches of his mind. Something about the report struck him as vaguely familiar. He laid aside a glossy photo of Yazid glaring malevolently at the camera. The answer suddenly struck Nichols. It was simple and it was shocking. He picked up his telephone and punched the coded number of a direct line, impatiently drumming the desktop with his fingers until a voice answered on the other end. "This is Brogan."
"Martin, thank heavens you're working late. This is Dale Nichols."
"What can I do for you, Dale?" asked the director of the CIA. "Did you get the packet on Ahmad Yazid?"
"Yes, thank you," replied Nichols. "I've gone through it and found something you can help me with."
"Sure, what is it?"
"I need two sets of blood types and fingerprints."
"Fingerprints?"
"That's right."
"We use genetic codes and DNA tracing nowadays," Brogan answered indulgently. "Any particular reason in mind?"
Nichols paused to collect his thoughts.
"If I tell you, I swear to God you'll think I should be fitted for a straitjacket."
Yeager pulled off his granny reading glasses, tucked them into the pocket of a denim jacket, shuffled and stacked a pile of computer reports, then settled back in his chair and sipped from a can of diet soda.
"Zilch," he said, almost sadly. "A wasted effort up and down the line. A 1,600-year-old trail is too cold to follow without solid data. A computer can't go back in time and tell you exactly how it was.
Maybe Dr. Gronquist can determine where the Serapis made landfall after he's had a chance to study the artifacts," Lily said optimistically. Pitt sat two rows below and off to one side from the others in Numa's small amphitheater.
"I talked to him by radio an hour ago. He's found nothing that isn't Mediterranean in origin. A three-dimensional projection of the Atlantic Ocean showing landfalls and the irregular geology of the sea bottom filled a screen above the stage. Everyone seemed obsessed by it. Their eyes were drawn to the contoured imagery even as they spoke. Everyone, that is, except Admiral James Sandecker. His eyes suspiciously observed Al Giordino, particularly the large cigar sprouting from one side of the assistant project director's mouth as if it had grown from a seedling.
When did you start buying Oyo de Monterey Excaliburs?"
Giordino looked at the Admiral with an innocent expression.
"You talking to me, Admiral?"
"Since you and I are the only ones in the theater smoking Excaliburs, and I'm not in the habit of talking to myself, yes."
"Great, full flavor," said Giordino, holding up the fat cigar and expelling a gush of blue smoke. "I commend your discriminating taste."
"Where did you get it?"
"A little shop in Baltimore, I forget the name."
Sandecker wasn't fooled for an instant. Giordino had been stealing his expensive cigars for years. What drove the Admiral up the wall was that he never discovered how. No matter how well he hid or locked them away, his inventory count always showed two missing every week. Giordino kept the secret from Pitt so his best friend would never have to lie if asked how it was done. Only Giordino and an old buddy from the Air Force who was a professional burglar for an intelligence agency knew the technicalities of Operation Stogie.
"I've a good notion to ask to see a receipt," growled Sandecker.
"We've been attacking this thing from the wrong angle," Pitt said, steering the meeting back on course.
"There's another angle?" asked Yeager. "We took the only logical approach open to us."
"Without any reference to direction, it was an impossible job," Lily backed him.
"A pity Rufinus didn't log his daily positions and distance traveled," mused Sandecker. "He was under strict orders not to record anything."
"Could they determine a position back then?" asked Giordino. Lily nodded.
"Hipparchus the Greek determined the positions of Earth landmarks by figuring their latitude and longitude 130 years before Christ." Sandecker laced his hands across his trim stomach and gazed at Pitt over his reading glasses.
"I know that lost look in your eyes. Something's nagging at you."
Pitt slouched in his seat.
"We've been judging facts and using guesswork without considering the man who conceived the smuggling plan."
"Junius Venator?"
A brilliant guy, Pitt continued, who was described by a contemporary as a daring innovator who struck out into areas other scholars feared to tread. The question we've overlooked is, if we were in Venator's shoes, where would we have taken and hidden the great art and literary treasures of our time? I still say Africa, volunteered Jaeger, preferably around the Cape somewhere up a river along the eastern coastline. Yet your computers couldn't make a marriage. They never came close, Jaeger admitted, but God only knows how land formations have changed since Venator's day. Could Venator have taken the fleet northeast into the Black Sea? Lily queried. Rufinus was specific about a voyage of 58 days, said Giordino. Sandecker, puffing his cigar, nodded. Yes, but if the fleet was hit by foul weather or adverse winds, they could have traveled less than 1,000 miles in that time. The admiral has a point, Jaeger conceded. Ancient ships of the period were constructed to run with the sea and before the wind. Their rigging was not efficient for windward sailing. Heavy weather conditions could have cut their progress by 80%. Except, Pitt said, hanging on the word, Venator loaded his ships with 4 times their normal supply of provisions. He planned for an extended voyage, said Lily, suddenly intrigued. Venator never intended to land every few days and resupply his fleet. All that proves to me, said Sandecker, is that Venator wanted to keep the entire voyage as secret as possible by never coming ashore and leaving a trail. Pitt shook his head. As soon as the ships cleared the Straits of Gibraltar, any need for secrecy evaporated. Venator was free and in the clear. Byzantine warships sent to stop him would be as much in the dark as we are of his next course heading. Jaeger looked quizzically at Pitt. So we put ourselves in Venator's shoes, or sandals, or whatever they wore then. What's our plan? Dr. Rothberg unknowingly came up with the key to the mystery, Pitt explained. He thought Venator buried the artifacts where no one of his day would think to look. Jaeger looked at him blankly. That could be anywhere in the ancient world. Or outside of the world, as the Romans knew it. Charted geography didn't extend very far below North Africa, or east of the Black Sea and Persian Gulf, said Lily. Nothing was explored beyond that. We don't know that, Pitt disagreed. Junius Venator had access to 4,000 years of man's knowledge. He knew of the existence of the African continent and the great steppes of Russia. He must have known of trade with India, which in turn imported and exported goods from China. And he'd have studied the records of voyages that sailed far beyond the usual Roman-Byzantine trade routes. We're certain the Alexandria Library had an entire section devoted to geographical records, said Lily. Venator could have worked from source maps compiled from much earlier times. What do you think he discovered that influenced him? Asked Sandecker. A direction, Pitt answered. All had focused their curiosity on Pitt, and he did not disappoint them. He walked down to the stage and picked up a flashlight that shone a small arrow on the 3-dimensional projection. The only question in my mind, said Giordino, is whether the fleet turned north or south. Neither. Pitt moved the lighted arrow through the Gibraltar Straits and across the Atlantic. Venator led his fleet west, to the Americas. His statement was greeted with stunned disbelief. There is no archaeological evidence supporting pre-Columbian contact in the Americas, Lily stated firmly. The Serapis is a pretty good indicator they could have made such a voyage, said Sandecker. It's a heated controversy, admitted Pitt. But there are too many similarities in Mayan art and culture that cannot be ignored. Ancient America may not have been as isolated from European and Asian influence as we once thought. Frankly, I buy it, said Jaeger, his enthusiasm restored. I'd bet my Willie Nelson record collection the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, and Vikings all landed on North and South American soil before Columbus. No self-respecting archaeologist would take you up on it, said Lily. Giordino grinned at her. That's because they won't stake their precious reputations on it. Sandecker looked at Jaeger. Let's give the project another try. Jaeger looked at Pitt. What shorelines do you want me to cover? Pitt scratched his chin. He realized he badly needed a shave. Begin at the fjord in Greenland and work south down to Panama. He paused to stare at the chart projection with thoughtful curiosity.
It has to be along there somewhere.